Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
People say, oh, well, there's segments of community that treat crypto like a religion. But fundamental to most religions is this concept of care for your neighbor and care for a stranger and a greater good and a higher purpose and all of that. And if this is a religion, well, it is not founded on those principles.
You're listening to CoinDesk's Money Reimagined with Michael Casey and Sheila Warren.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Money Reimagined. I'm Michael Casey and I'm here on one of what I often look forward to the most is we have wonderful guests, but I actually really do enjoy doing these ones where I just sit down and talk to my wonderful co-host, Sheila Warren. It's just the two of us.
It's just us.
That's terrible. I'm going to do that. All right. Casey is not going to break into song. That is not going to happen.
We all heard it in our minds.
I mean, you can poll our audience if they want me to sing, but I'm not going to sing.
Oh, musical episode. It's a great idea.
No, it's not.
Special musical guest.
I love it. No. All right. So unfortunately, you haven't been all that well.
Oh, my God.
Poor thing.
I know. Yes, I have been quite ill. I've been lying in bed battling the flu, as it turns out, which, the gift
I remember
that.
I'm
giving. The gift
that was another bad disease. Yeah, horrible. But the thing about the flu is like it just gets your head racing, I find. Like, I mean, not always in the right place. If you take it too bad, your thoughts can go in all sorts of directions. But it does give you time to think, and you've been doing some thinking.
Well, sure enough. I mean, I'm lying here, I'm like, do I wish for death? Is that the answer? Is it time to just, and really been like blowing up this this virus with whatever medications I could find? You know, I have been thinking quite a bit, and I think we could take this a number of different directions. I've been thinking a lot about this topic of intersectionality that we talk about among technology, also tech and culture. But I'm hoping we can chat today a little more about the culture side of things and not necessarily even, I mean, look, I've been spending some cycles thinking about just the increasing and pointed toxicity in certain corners of the cryptoverse, spearheaded, I think, by X, formerly known as Twitter, and how that has changed. And that medium of exchange of content and exchange of ideas has changed a lot since change of ownership over there. I've also been thinking about crypto in the broader culture, kind of things like, well, some of the things you focus on in your book, like very much so, right? Like, how do we get back to some of those topics, the things that I think brought people like you and me to the space to begin with? Things like, how can we have a more equitable and inclusive democracy? How can we create new forms of governance? How can we, all of it, right? All the things, how can we self-ownership of data and what that means, empowerment within systems, like all those things. How do we get back to those pure impulses in a broader way culturally, as opposed to the, well, now the market is back and let's go back to our kind of, brute force assault on values, kind of approach, right?
Mm. Well, it's funny, like I remember at various times in my, engagement with the crypto community over the last 10 or so years that I've been doing so, whenever I would like wade into this and just say, we just need to be better people. There was a certain subset of the community who would just say the very idea that some journalist is out there claiming that we could be better is in and of itself an act of censorship and control. Like there's one particular guy who will go unnamed who would every single time he would just rant and he just said the most horrible things to me because it was in their mind the classic virtue signaling, right? That, oh, there you go, you know, when in fact the only way to fix this is to let everything go, just to have pure, unadulterated madness of opinions. And toxicity is a feature, not a bug, is what some of these folks would say, right? And I mean, somewhere along the line, there is this notion of what is decent human behavior. I think if you polled most people, they'd have a pretty good idea about what that was. And that in fact, if you, you know, look at the foundations of civilization, it's not just, you know, the rule of law and, you know, capitalism and everything else. It's literally the formation of these ideas of what it is to be a human and a member of a society and to be a good, you know, a good citizen. And so these ideas, they are actually relatively universally understood. It doesn't mean that, you know, you have these wide ranges that you have to accommodate, that free speech and all these things are critical to any functioning society. But yeah, I find one of the most difficult things sometimes in dealing with the crypto community is like, there's a view out there that just even suggesting that we should be better to each other is wrong. And I'm done. I just don't know what to do with that. I really don't know what to do with it.
People say, oh, well, there's segments of community that treat crypto like a religion. But, you know, fundamental to most religions is this concept of care for your neighbor and care for a stranger and a greater good and a higher purpose and all of that. And if this is a religion, well, it is not founded on those principles. And I'm reminded as we're talking about a conversation you and I had, we started the pod. So it must have been, well, in bounds of 3 years, but it was pretty early on in the pod. And we were still getting to be the close friends we are now. And I was so perturbed by images I was seeing coming from a conference in Miami that will go unnamed, but it's the big conference that happens in Miami every year. And I was so disgusted, honestly, by just some of the images coming out of this. And it kind of dominated our, you know, our corner of the Twitterverse for a little while. And I called you just saying, like, what are we even doing here? Like, what is this? You know, you just said, like, listen, we can't let you use a word I thought was very appropriate, but it's profanity. So we'll just, I don't think we can beep ourselves on the show, but you know, whatever you
bleep
say, don't
it
let,
say it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bleep it.
You said you can't let those beep, you know, win, right? Yeah. You can't, we can't let them win. They don't own the conversation. They're but a small part. They're a very loud part, but a small part of this. And it was really helpful to me because I was able to contextualize it and to remind myself, look, I've worked in finance. I've worked in the highest echelons of Wall Street law, right? I've worked at the World Economic Forum. Like, I've seen disgusting behavior in every place I've ever worked that involves power. Where there are people in power, there is disgusting stuff that happens for sure. And this is no different, right? This is no different. But it feels worse, I think, because it often feels like folks like you and I, and the very large number of people that believe the things we believe and feel the way we feel, we're not by any means, like, you know, alone in this. There's a huge number, but most of those people are too busy doing the work to have a gigantic public voice. They're not spending a lot of time on places like Twitter or, and we'll not call it X. Can we just call it? I think we've agreed we're going to call it
Twitter.
They don't go to places like that, right? They're not like spending all their time like making memes about nonsense or whatever, some of which are very funny, to be fair, but they're not doing that. They're doing the work, right? They're doing the very hard work of thinking through in great detail the different kinds of questions that need to be addressed in order to actually build better, more equitable systems, which are real, some of which are technical, some of which are about culture, all kinds of questions. And so I guess I'm throwing out a lifeline here, you know, because this is getting depressing, but like, you know, you've been on this book tour, you wrote a book that focuses on one part of the challenge that I think you and I think is really important. Are you finding that that's getting, is there a movement growing here, right? Like, is there countercultural to crypto culture? Is there a movement that's kind of forming here to bring back some of these conversations and put them more into the spotlight?
I hope so. I don't think it's probably too early to say, but I mean, I know that the book is resonating with people because they're saying, hey, this is something that needs to be fixed. And that there is perhaps things that can be done, some of which involves using crypto-related technologies to address the inequities and you know, distortions on the internet. But I think one way to actually address it that's interesting is, so the book uses the framing of the American project. It starts off talking about Thomas Paine and Thomas Paine's, you know, very important work, Common Sense, sort of like did a couple of things. It pointed to the problem and said, like, you know, this is ridiculous. The monarchy, it's the emperor has no clothes. It is absurd. Divine rule. What an absurd idea. And there is really just nothing we can do anymore to keep petitioning the king to fix our problems. Now's the time for independence. You got it done. That's one point there. The rest of it was like, he sort of lays out what a good society would be that is one that's founded on democracy and individual rights and so forth. And he goes through this process of talking about the formation of a society. And then the government is the thing that you do at the end that is, it's unfortunately, it's the vices that need to be addressed. The rest of it is the important part of building rights. And then the virtues, he talks about the virtues of a society because people will see the mutual benefit that comes from working together. And then eventually, because humans are going to human, you have to have a government. That was the kind of structure. And we sort of talked about, okay, what would those phases look like in a digital environment? That was the thing. So what's interesting about this is, like, Paine was not prescriptive. He didn't say, this is what a good government model should be. It's like, we just have to establish independence and the rest of us have to come together and figure this out. And self-governance is the answer. And, you know, so, but that's that whole process of whatever the constitution is going to look like and, you know, how many houses of parliament you're going to have and all of that. I'm not telling you to do that. That's, you guys go off and figure that out. I think about that and I think about now and it does, like, lend itself to the sort of the crypto principle that no one has the answer. This has to be a collective undertaking, which some people might argue is therefore, okay, so toxicity wins because we just let whatever happens happen. And that's not actually what happened in the 70s. There was all sorts of mores of behavior and, like, you know, there were all these structures to how people were decent to each other that then helped formulate and form the framework for the US Constitution and the government and then the society that came from that. We talk about in the book about the magic source for a functioning society is the protection of those rights, but just by the same token, these obligations that are built into the behaviors that we have, whether it's lining up, queuing for something, not throwing litter out your window, saying please and thank you, you name it. All of these things are aspects of what works. So I suppose where I want to go with this is, like, what can we do to actually sort of elevate that kind of behavior in a sort of like the norms and mores that without dictating, here's what good behavior is and here's what isn't, but actually we collectively know that we need to treat each other this way if we're going to do it, right?
Well, it's just the sheer concept that we have obligations to each other and to each other because we're human beings on the planet Earth, not because we have a particular...
You can't have a right without somebody actually fulfilling an obligation to protect that right. So they are...
So they are flip sides of the same coin. They always have been. You can talk about rights and privileges, you can talk about rights and obligations, but the idea is there has to be some enforcement mechanism around the right and what it means to have a right. And if there isn't accountability around denial of that right, then what are we even doing here? And I think, you know, it's fair to say, I mean, I started this by thinking more about the sort of crypto bubble that we tend to occupy a lot of the time in our day work, but this is a broader problem, obviously. I mean, I spend, as we know, a lot of time in Washington, which is not exactly a bastion of care and altruistic behavior at the current moment in time, quite the opposite. And again, you're seeing that what is very clearly a minority, like by numbers, by volume, by whatever it is having a dominant voice. And the same thing is happening in other spheres as well, including spheres of which I'm just not as much of a part, but I know it's happening in broader culture. It's happening certainly in the DEI or anti-DEI kind of movement, which I do feel unfortunately is a movement, which again is a number of powerful, but loud, more loud than powerful, I would argue, folks making certain statements and saying certain things. And so this is happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere. Where it's leading my thinking is really along the lines of, you know, as a longtime advocate both for free speech and for privacy, it's complicated because when you combine free speech and privacy on the internet, you get things like Nazis making meme coins on Solana. You know what I mean? Like, because they're private and they're anonymous and it's free speech. And it's like, oh my God, well, that is certainly not the desired outcome. Hmm. And I would have said prior to the age of rapid dissemination of minority viewpoints that are very toxic, I would have said, I think like in the 80s and 90s, you know, people need to say what they're going to say and we flush ideas out of the public sphere and we debate them and we decide. The problem with that approach now is the virality, and I use that term literally, right? The virality and the toxicity of those ideas and the impact that they have, which is much broader, I think, than it ever used to be. And we have to factor that in. We have to factor the sheer velocity of dissemination of toxic ideas into this. So the other thing I'm thinking about is the whole drama between Elon Musk and Yael Roth at Twitter, when it was still Twitter. And for those who are not familiar, it's actually worth a quick Google on this. But the bottom line is Yael Roth was the person, the man who led content moderation, essentially, and safety at Twitter. And he stayed on when Elon came in, but then he eventually left and it was all very dramatic. And this all came to a head at Kara Swisher's, or I guess not her conference anymore, the Code conference, where there was almost kind of a head-to-head fireside chat sort of showdown that kind of happened between Yael going on and talking about the erosion of safety and soundness and any sort of content moderation protections and whatnot on the platform. And Linda Yaccarino is the current CEO of X coming in and trying to defend against that. And all the whole thing was all, again, worth a Google if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about. But Michael, you know, just reactions to that, right? Like, do we need to think more about what are the boundaries of decency, right? What are the boundaries of decency and how do we think about them differently in the digital domain?
Well, the question, I suppose, is like, again, like once you say moderation of that, right? Who gets to decide? That is still a problem. Let's acknowledge that, right? Regardless of whether or not we think, you know, Elon has somehow improved this thing called Twitter or X, whatever it is. The argument that any single person or even a committee should have the power to moderate is really problematic. Which ultimately gets to the core problem, which I, you know, again, the book focuses on this. Like, we've allowed for these gigantic platforms to become the town squares, and they are not neutral parties. That is the core thing, right?
Yeah.
Even if Yael was absolutely well-intended, and I believe he was, it's not to say that this isn't. And the same thing we saw with the craziness of the Gemini, the Google Gemini, you know, photo screw-up the other day with the, you know, like, you know, you're going to tweak the algorithm to try to, you know, address these DEI concerns. That's well-intended perhaps, but the outcome should not be that the algorithm decides that there are black people in the among the founding fathers, right? So, you know, this idea that there's a committee making these decisions on what moderation should look like is just inherently problematic, which then says, okay, well, the problem really is the actual structure of how we have organized this information system around these platforms. And so I think the question of how do we get behavior to be better cannot be disentangled from what are the incentives out there, right? Now, this is a much harder problem than we think it is, but it's nonetheless relevant, right? Because, I mean, I always like to think of Brexit, for example, and Facebook has done a lot that's changed since then and others, but, you know, we know that the incentives of Facebook's, literally its shareholders, the return they were getting from advertisers, geared itself toward enabling partners like Cambridge Analytica come in and create these like-minded groups and target them in certain ways, because that would just build engagement and therefore build returns and advertisers, and they'd be able to charge Cambridge Analytica and advertisers and everybody else for being part of this thing. So the whole thing, when you rolled it right back to the actual incentives of the platform itself, lent itself, encouraged what was ultimately a distorted election because of what Cambridge Analytica did. I mean, there's no dispute over this, by the way. Like, those who think, like, I mean, I was just reading this tremendous essay in the New Yorker, I think two editions ago, about what's happened to the UK conservative movement over the last however many years that they've been in power, which is a remarkably long time, 12, 13 years, I think it is, maybe even longer. No, it's actually right back to 2009. Gordon Brown, I think, was the last one. Right? So we're doing 15 years of Tory power. Austerity and Brexit, these kind of disastrous outcomes. And ultimately, you know, they still talk about Brexit as if it was something that just was the result. That's what the people wanted. It was a completely manipulated thing, right?
Yeah,
and so this all, but the things like the alignment between the interests of the platform and of people who are going to distort and create misinformation and essentially this bad behavior stuff we're talking about, that's part of the problem. So one thing is to, like, okay, how do we create an environment in which people are actually incentivized not to behave in this way, but to actually sort of start to form communities who would start behaving better towards each other? I don't, this again, not an easy thing to fix. And I'd mentioned this on stage recently, and our mutual friend Paul Brody was like, people are still going to be on no matter what. And I'm like, yes, but at least it's not like built into the entire ecosystem of the model, the entire economic model. So the thing is, like, it's still about incentives. Like, you are incentivized. Like, think about the sort of political agitators. And I, you know, again, I'm obviously my politics tend to go in a certain way. So I tend to be more inclined, but you see it on both sides. You certainly see it on the left as much as the right. But there was one thing, you know, yesterday, you know, Biden had put out that statement about it happened to be on Sunday. So it happened to be on, therefore, Easter Sunday, acknowledging, you know, transgender awareness, right? This is a statement that the White House has been putting out since 2008.
Yep.
But it was so easy for anybody in the right to pick up and just say, this is a horrible, the offense of it all, the blasphemous, even knowing that this is, like, it's very easy to say, like, this is shit. Like, the White House has been acknowledging this day for 16 years.
Yeah.
But you can say this because the incentives are there to do so. Because you will get a rise, you'll get a clicks, you'll get follows. Anybody. Well,
that's it, right? I mean, to your point, it's a bit deck chairs in the Titanic. Like, when the town square is actually a very controlled corporate square, you know, there's nothing town about it really, right? It's just completely controlled by a small group of folks who have certain incentives that are not aligned with everyone else's incentives, or that certainly aligned with anything that involves the betterment of society necessarily. And if your motivation is clicks and likes in pursuit of those kinds of things, it's going to lead to certain kinds of behaviors. But it is a bit moving deck chairs in the Titanic, because the Titanic is the problem. It's not the chair. It's not the orchestra. The Titanic. It's the Titanic that's the problem, right? Like, that's the issue. It's the iceberg. It's
at least then you can see the ship and the iceberg.
And you're right. And fundamentally, you know, within that construct, the reality is that nobody has any power apart from a very small handful of individuals who have incentives that are almost exclusively about making money. And the way to do that is, you know, X, Y, and Z, which are all things that very much, as is well documented in many places, are about encouraging what I think we would call antisocial behavior. And that is, to your point, a feature, not at all a bug.
And it doesn't always have to be the most antisocial. You and I have talked about, like, whether or not we think the most aggressive approach around policy in the crypto space is the right thing to do. Should they be taking it to, you know, the SEC and using inflammatory language? And should they be, you know, trying to rile up every single, deliberately going after certain politicians? And or should there be an act of, like, a classic Washington approach of trying to, like, build compromise and everything else? You know, it's not just, by the way, it's not just in crypto. It's in politics that whole model has gone out the window, because you get so much more engagement if you are an extremist. But I'm not going to name names of certain people in crypto who I think, you know, they're inclined toward this more radical stick it to them pitchfork approach, because it gives them more clicks, because their follower list goes up, because it's a much easier way to get, you know, the literally the monetary value that you can get from being a high profile person on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, by being a loudmouth. Is that the most effective way for crypto to actually get policy change? I don't know.
I'm excited to share with you that our biggest fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age, a book I co-authored with Project Liberty founder Frank McCourt, will be released on March 12 and is now available for pre-order. Our biggest fight is a manifesto on the need to fix a severely broken internet with a set of workable solutions for all of us to follow. It's a hopeful book, exploring the big opportunities for innovation and prosperity that technology can bring if it's designed with humans in mind. But it's also an urgent call to action. We must get this right for society now, before it's too late. Find the link to the book in the show notes. Global crypto regulation, the disruptive power of AI, the rise of tokenization, Consensus is the one event where experts in digital assets, blockchain, and related topics convene to talk about the ideas shaping our digital future. Join developers, investors, founders, brands, policymakers, and plenty more in Austin, Texas from May 29 to 31. The 10th annual Consensus is curated by CoinDesk to feature the industry's most sought-after speakers, unparalleled networking opportunities, and unforgettable experiences. Take 15% off registration with the code MRP15. Register now at consensus.coindesk.com.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because I think in certain cases, like, look, when you have to take it to the courts, you're absolutely, I think the right thing to do is to take it to the courts loudly. If you're going to be filing lawsuit against an agency like the SEC, you're already doing that. You may as well pile on, you know, what's going to change, right? That's not going to affect the outcome. You have a judge, you have a jury, they're meant to be impartial. They're going to make a decision they're going to make. Going on and on about it is not affecting the outcome in any meaningful way because it is in a process. When it comes to policy making, which is a process of persuasion of various individuals through education, through what we like to call evidence-based advocacy, although not everyone's advocacy is evidence-based, ours definitely is, regardless, that is a longer process. It involves compromise, it involves negotiation, it involves understanding of priorities, you know, all these kinds of things, right? In that process, I think there's a different approach that tends to yield results. And so they are not the same thing. And the approach that you'd use in a litigious environment versus in a policy advocacy environment, I believe are not the same, right? But that's a nuance that's lost on many, I think.
Well, and, again, because there's an incentive not do so.
Yeah. You
know? I think it gets around to the same thing. Like, you know, am I incentivized to, you know, throw barbs at something on Twitter? Well, yeah, you're going to get a rise out of it. Like, make somebody look like a fool, make them look like an idiot, like, you know, mock them. Yeah, that works. It often does. You know, like,
well, you know, it's they often say, like, do you want to win or do you want to be right? Right. Kind of thing. Right. And those which are different. But I actually think it's like, do you win? Do you want to be right? Or do you want to be seen as being right and as being morally having the moral?
Well, that's a problem.
It's a third thing. Right. And like, I have always cared very little about the being seen as being the whatever can occupying the moral high ground and whatever. To me, that is, if that is in service of the end, great. If not, who cares? But a lot of folks are in, you know, to the points you're making, like the whole TikTok influencer thing. Like, people are not there because they think there's inherent value.
But this is all about incentive.
Incentive.
Like, if you're an influencer, you are going to make more money and have more. If you have more followers, you're going to have more subscribers. That's what it is, right? Like, and therefore, you actually are aligning the being right, if that's the right word, or like getting the most attention.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, in the long run, the objective about what you're talking about, the actual policy change or issue that you care about that you're trying to drive is going to get nowhere with this approach. You are aligned economically with just going all out and getting a rise out of people than taking that more sort of higher ground position. So because it's literally paying off in terms of you know, the tension metrics of this online economy in which we all exist. That is the problem, right? Like, we're all incentivized to get, you know, a bigger rise out of people.
Yeah.
And so how on earth do you build a political system around that, right? I mean, just one of the things we talk about in the book is like, just, it's a pretty easy thought experiment. Just go through a list of, you know, House of Representatives members and look at which ones have got the biggest, you know, followerships, and they tend to be the most extreme minded people.
Yeah. Here's what's interesting about that when it comes to, just to tie a couple of things together, to crypto policy, right? So you would think, given the default or more common approach on, you know, crypto Twitter of being very loud, very vitriolic, memeing everything, you know, all of this, sometimes tongue in cheek and hilarious, sometimes actually quite vicious, sometimes I would actually say like inciting to violence, which is a crime. Out there, that is actually literally a crime, especially against a public figure. The folks that are the most firebrandy in Congress are not actually on side with crypto. They're just not. It's not an issue for them. They don't care. Right. The irony is that the people that are actually on side in crypto, and this is on both sides of the aisle, tend to be a little more moderate. And even if they are extreme politically, they tend to be a bit more moderate in their views on crypto. And it's very funny to me that there is this sense that, well, the louder we are and the more crazy we are, the more we're going to attract. You know, it's like, no, that has not proven to be true. And it's not true. And if anything, the people who are on side already, the kind of allies that we already have, the Republican allies, for example, they're really not happy about the behavior. They are very upset about it. So like, it doesn't actually help us build bridges with the folks we have to build bridges with to get policy made. It doesn't help us at all. The crazier that you people look, the harder it is for us to do our jobs, right? So it is actually a counterproductive strategy if the goal is to actually get policy, you know, through, right? Mm-hmm. And to get people incentivized, to use our term, to get people incentivized, elected officials incentivized to actually create policy that is for the betterment of users of the crypto industry and for consumers and for the industry itself. If that's the goal, there's a way to do that. And it is certainly not.
Yeah. I mean, there's actually a very good recent example of this being a problem. And that's Katie Porter, who is, you know, she ran against Adam Schiff and she really never took a position on crypto. But she, I think, has been closely aligned with Elizabeth Warren. Mm. So there was actually a big spend in the, you know, Fair Shake movement. Yeah. You know, and it was, and she lost. She lost a primary against Adam Schiff running for the Senate seat that Dianne Feinstein opened up in your good state. And I heard from somebody who was connected with her, it was like, she basically said, what did I do? And she was like, and so now, you know, wherever she ends up in politics and you know, she may end up like, you know, who knows, the attorney general in you know, California or something, right? She's now got a chip on her shoulder about crypto.
Is there, yeah.
And she actually sort of is supposed to could become more of an opponent and a barrier because she was used as a vehicle.
Okay. So I think that was about fundamentally proving that crypto money, which I think is a distinct thing from crypto voters, crypto money could actually be influential in a primary election. And I have no idea if that's true or not, if that made a difference. I don't know. What I can tell you as a very longstanding Californian who knew that race extremely closely, bluntly and with respect, I don't know a single person who voted for Katie Porter.
Oh, okay.
If anything, I know people who were furious about her throwing her hat in the ring and ceding a very purpley district to a possible Republican takeover at a time when the House is so tight, who were like livid about that. The party was upset about it. A lot of her supporters were mad about it because the idea was and look, this is how this works. For better or for worse, I would argue very much for worse. For better or for worse, there's a lot of, you know, it's your turn, you earn this, whatever, that was going to Adam Schiff. Okay. And it was Adam Schiff's turn. He had the backing of the entire establishment, blah, 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 blah. Fine. It was a long shot that she was going to get it anyway. But okay, you take your shot if you want to. But it really rankled the party.
I'm sure it did.
That
makes a lot of sense.
A lot of Californians were very pissed off.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense. But it's also like, whether or not it was an it was effective.
But now she's very anti-crypto for sure. Outcome is she didn't win, which I would argue she was not going to anyway, but regardless, fine. Crypto money was arguably a factor that was relevant there. Probably true. I actually don't really know for sure one way or the other, but you know, it certainly was not a non-factor. Mm-hmm. And she is now 100% anti-crypto, no question, and never coming back, right?
Right.
So yes, you know, views on that are going to differ. The outcome of the election, I would argue it would have been exactly the same. Nevertheless, I think that the point by some industry was to demonstrate that this is a relevant political force. And I do think crypto is a relevant political force. And I do think that's a point to be made. And I do think those things, you know, are part of a broader approach to thinking about, you know, how to land effective policy through the U.S. Congress, which is landing any policy is not an easy thing to do, as is obvious, let alone policy on a sort of niche area that a lot of folks still don't understand or particularly care about, right? So, fine. At one point, are you actively trying to create enemies? And this is what I always find so hilarious and I'm somewhat comical about crypto is at the same time, it's like, we want to be the underdog. Oh, we're here. We're taking on the big banks. We're the little guy. We're only here to like make things better and make improvements to systems that haven't served people, yada, yada, yada. But also we have this giant stick and we're going to come and crush you. You know, it's like you kind of, and the same people say both things, which I find just absolutely hilarious. But you know, in the sort of hypocrisy of it all. But the reality is this is still a very small industry by most measures, right? And yes, there is an outsized amount of political power being wielded by the industry. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, given how much the industry has been reviled in ways that I don't think are fair at all. Gary Gensler being, you know, chief architect of this kind of strategy, which in ways I think are just based on bad facts, frankly, which, you know, as you and I have discussed, like, he knows better. So there is something to be said for the fact that she's been vilified in a lot of places. On the flip side of that, of course, we just had Sam Bankman-Fried, 25 years in prison, which I said in the press, I was surprised by how low the sentence was. I thought it'd be higher, frankly, for what he did, right? When you zoom out a little bit, you're like, well, people hate you. Sometimes there's a reason, and maybe, you know, you need to acknowledge some of that and take your, you know, take the collective hit and kind of move on, right? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I mean, I look at policy being made on the basis of cultural stereotype.
Yeah.
And, you know, and just thinking, oh my God, like on two sides, like how on earth did we create that cultural stereotype to the detriment of the industry? And like, can you possibly be a little bit more grown up, Gary Gensler, or whomever it is that's like, all you focused on is some loudmouth and a stupid, you know, Bitcoin bling hat, right? To think that that's what's going to drive your policy stance, that this stereotype of the bro, like, it's just look at the tech, look at what it's doing, and understand where there are exploitative, real abuses like Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX and where it's not, and not lumping it all together. So there's like a lack of sophistication by design, I think, by, you know, certainly, you know, the regulators like Gensler who do know better and have just allowed themselves to be captured by, you know, this sort of very simplistic, overarching perception of that. And on the side of the industry for just embracing it and saying, yeah, we're happy to be seen
there. Here's the thing, right? Like, I think we like to think that someone's coming to save us, and very smart, nuanced, thoughtful people are the ones in positions making all the decisions, right? Which is just untrue. And every time I start to get frustrated by that, I think about my voting patterns, okay? And I'm very honest about this. So I have voted in every election since I was old enough to vote. We take our kids to the poll. It's like, you vote. It is your job as a citizen. I don't care where you are. I don't care how hard it is. I don't care what kind of, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles you have to take to get to your poll, to get your ballot, whatever. You vote. You vote. But let's be real, okay? When I was a 19-year-old college student voting, I really had no business voting for a school board in Massachusetts or whatever the hell, right? I didn't know anything about the topic. I didn't know who the people were. I didn't even know where to go to get the right information. I didn't even know who to proxy to, right? And I remember there's times I would just like mark bubbles. Oh, this person was already there. Seems fine. Oh, whatever, you know? And so the idea that as a person who is a, you know, I like to think I'm an intelligent, educated person, I'm sincere, I do my best, you know, et cetera. But there are still moments in my life, and yes, 19-year-olds are generally not known for their amazing decision-making abilities regardless, right? There are moments in my life as a decision maker, which is what a voting is, you're deciding something collectively, but you're deciding for yourself. I made some dumb decisions because I didn't know what I was talking about. I had no idea what the factors even were, you know? And the reality is that happens sometimes. But that happens now because people have a million things on their plate. You know, and a lot of these elected officials, like, this is not their financial, that's not their priority. They came in to do something on reproductive rights, on voting rights, on gerrymandering, on clean air and water, on policing, on crime, on things that I would argue are extremely important to a functioning society, right? To rural broadband or infrastructure, to whatever it is. And they have to form an opinion and make a vote on this thing. And they're going to proxy in. They're going to look around. Oh, how's so-and-so voting? What do they know? Who's the person I think is the expert? You know, a lot of it is kind of, that's how it works. And so if there's a person, that's why I think Gary Gensler has drawn rightfully drawn such vitriol, because he's somebody who is in a position to know better, to know who to talk to know who the real experts are and all of that, and has chosen to do differently and is seen by many, or at least was until the sort of, I actually think that Gary Gensler is now a not beloved individual by most of Washington, leaving aside the industry. And the wool has been pulled and people kind of see what's going on there for the sort of situation that it is. Regardless, I do think that, you know, he's a proxy for some people who are like, well, if the chair of the SEC hates this company, this industry, this whatever, then there must be something there. And I don't have to bother knowing about it because he knows and I can just kind of try. You know, that's how people often make decisions. That was me with the school board.
It's kind of like the height of representative democracy it actually is. Like just elect me. Yeah. I'm in favor of all these things that you tend to support. So, you know, I'm going to look out.
That's enough. Right? Yeah.
But this is an unelected official. It's funny how we've taken this conversation on culture and we ended up with Gary Gensler. But
well, if you're going to talk about crypto culture, he's villain number one. So you kind of have to think about how he's being approached, right?
It is.
Oh, my goodness.
I think that figuring out, again, how do we incentivize the right kind of behavior? Here's something I was thinking about as you were saying this. Like, as a society, sadly, I think now the attention on Gaza is just because people are just so tired of it, right? But I would even argue when everybody was obsessed with it, in some respects, it's not our business to be that invested into it, right? It's not to say we don't shouldn't care. This is something we should absolutely care about. But what these algorithms do is they take some polemical issue and they make it front and center of your daily life. You know what really matters? Whether or not the homeless shelter down your street is actually got enough beds for the people who are there, or you know, your fire department, are they properly resourced to address a crisis? You know, what's the flood management like in your town now that you know water levels are rising? And you know, these are actually local issues that really should be, but we don't have local press anymore. We don't have local, you know, mechanisms to talk about these things. So you know, what we end up doing is all being corralled en masse, all 5 billion of us on the internet, to like banging over each other polarizingly on whether or not, you know, this is Israel or, you know, the Palestinians' fault and so forth, right? And there's really not a lot. We should care and we should be out there and agitating whatever it is you believe in. But at the same time, it's recognizing that inordinate amount of attention is in and of itself a construct of a platform that is wanting you to get engaged and polarized.
Yeah.
Is part of the problem, right? There's an element to all of this as a crypto culture as well. We can't divorce crypto culture because it is truly a social media first culture. It emerged in the social media era. Yeah. It's a product of the Web 2.0 era. And therefore, our culture is a direct outcome of these algorithmic systems that are just badly designed. That's an advertisement for my book, by the way.
Here's the irony, I think, and I think it is irony, you know, is that one of the points, like I talk a lot about micro communities and thinking about scale in a different way, right? And part of the beauty, I think, of blockchain-based communities and tokens and the ways you can govern those communities is that you can be hyper-local. You actually can be hyper-local. And that is much easier really to spin up. And this is the thing I find the most powerful, compelling thing about blockchain is not massive scale and everyone's trading tokens through one or two or whatever. Like that's whatever. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this is the idea that you can create empowerment within hyper-local situations that don't have to be geographic. Because right now, I'm part of our neighborhood association. One of the things my husband and I are proudest of is that we got speed bumps placed on our street. Took us 2.5 years.
There you go. That's real action.
Yeah. It's real action. 2.5 years of this, but there are now speed bumps. And this street used to be, people would just speed down our street, just park across the street. Yeah. Very dangerous, you know, super, super dangerous. And now, you know, it's significantly safer because we got these stupid concrete bumps, like literally, like it took like 2 hours to install them, but it took 2.5 years of like the city and talking to planning and talking to blah, 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 and whoever, and, you know, Department of the Streets and all that kind of stuff. Regardless, I'm part of that. But you can do that digitally now, right? That to me is the theory of change, is the ability to create hyperlocal communities that can agitate for change that's meaningful. And then to spin those communities down very simply.
Yeah.
Spin them up, spin them down. Right? That is the premise of a DAO fundamentally.
Yeah.
There's a whole discussion we could have. I know we have to wrap.
I know. We've got to run. One quick point on that, because I think it's valid. I mean, the book, like, just to make that pitch again, it's Our Biggest Fight, co-written with Frank McCourt. We talk about like data, this concept of data unions that Sandy Pentland at MIT Media Lab got me excited about. Yeah. You know, and it's like, so data unions are an interesting way to think about how we might collectively improve our bargaining power in an environment which we control and own our own data. Because one of the arguments people make, I think largely from a self-interested Silicon Valley perspective, is like, sorry guys, I know it'd be a nice idea if you owned your own data, but you have no political, you know, it's not worth anything in and of itself. Fundamentally, that's also wrong. Because well, it's not really wrong, but it's like they're immediately describing a paradigm that we are talking about upending anyway. So it's of no value in an environment where data is aggregated under these central platforms. In a world where everybody had their own data, who knows? You could all sorts of things that could emerge out of that. But one of the things that people do say is like, okay, what about the idea of collectives, like co-ops? These are things that have existed, you know, through farming communities, that, you know, the end of feudalism led to the emergence of co-ops, and so that like small farmers could band together. Similar ideas are being banded around about data now. But what Sandy says, this is really interesting, is that like to like break the cycle of this mass aggregation, data unions should be formed maybe around physical organizations, like geographic locations.
Yep.
So that, yes, your online community, your data union, is the same people who have the same cares about the speed bumps So that's what you're directed toward, as opposed to all rallying around Gaza on either side, right? Yeah. So an interesting way to think about this similar concept of like, how do we reconstruct communities of interest so that there is the tension that needs to be, we need to argue about things. We're not all just in an echo chamber, but we're actually grappling with things that matter to our daily lives. That, I think, hopefully, you know, it does lead to better behavior because you're acting in this citizen type role. Okay, I'm going to go and as my good citizen, I'm going to vote, I'm going to argue, I'm going to have, but I'm going to do so with a concern for this thing that I want to change. And I'm going to respectfully listen to the other person's view on that and deal with it, as opposed to something I can't change. I'm just going to yell at them over it because it's virtue signaling or whatever you want to call it, right? So there's something about that hyper-local, and I agree with you, blockchains can be really powerful because they create governance DAOs, whatever you want to call it, models around you know a common interest that is narrow as opposed to broad. So anyway, it's
no, there's an entirely different conversation that we need to have at some point. I'm just going to bookmark this before we wrap. On the erosion of local media and the harm that's caused. I mean, that's a really important conversation that I think we should just have. I think it's just, it's so emblematic of so many other problems, right? I have a friend from college, a good friend who went to the Texas Tribune to run at Sewell Chan and just observing his experience there at this kind of local Texas paper. And
I cut my teeth as a journalist at a local
newspaper. Yeah, Sonal Shah's there. You know, it would be really interesting to just talk about that and think about just what that is in that community and what it means, right? Like, that'd be very interesting.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And the other thing is, you know, just the reality that, you know, you over and over again, what do you see emerging? Racism, anti-Semitism, misogyny, you know, it's everything from the next door, oh my God, there's a person of color doing a thing. Oh my God, call the police, you know, all the way to Solana Nazi meme coins. You know, these tropes that just show up again and again and again and are so incredibly disgusting and troubling. And how when people get a certain measure of energy, you know, there's this group, right? There's like, I forget what it's called now, but there's like X is law, which is like, if you get to a certain tipping point, then, oh, here are the Nazis. Like every time.
Yeah.
The community of a certain number. And then at X plus one, it's like, there are the Nazis, you know, kind of crazy. Disgusting. But like, I think that's there's something in there as well, which is to say that one of the beauties of hyper-local communities, in my view, is that they're small enough that you don't hit that tipping point number and you actually are able to not bring in that toxicity. And I think it's been interesting to think about, and I haven't studied this in any way, but to look back on sort of crypto Twitter and how it started off as this, it used to be a really lovely place in many ways. And as it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, it got grosser and grosser and grosser and grosser. And that is the evolution of many communities, regardless of where they sit or live or what they're formed for. You know, that's just a disgusting fact, I suppose, about humanity. But on that depressing note.
Godwin's Law. I know we have a lot of smart and very engaged readers, listeners who'd be like, what? I don't know what that is. It's Godwin's Law. I just had to. I know I, too, had a bit of a.
Brain death on it. Yeah. I'll put that down to the flu meds.
Okay. Alrighty, listen, we need to wrap. Great to have these meandering, unstructured conversations every now and then. Never quite sure where they're going to end up. I always find them fun, I hope. You listeners do as well. And we will be back next week. Next time, I think we're going to have a guest on. So we'll be mixing it up as we always do. So thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank Michelle Musso, our wonderful editor-producer, who really runs all this stuff. Like there's no way that we could do anything without her help. But do come back next week. Do share your thoughts with us. Email us. You know, pay attention. Keep engaging with us. We do love your feedback. See you next week.